Come closer, friends. You are going to want to hear this. Have I got something for you? It's the newest technological marvel. It's the thing that you have to have. You see this here? Accept no excuses, accept no substitutions. Everybody who's anybody has one of these. It replaces all your old devices with this brand new one. It's new, it's shiny, it's novel. It does everything that you needed to do in your hectic life. It does things that you didn't even know you needed done. Get one of these today, it'll put a spring in your step and a song in your heart. It's the latest, greatest thing. Step right up. Have you ever stopped for a minute and thought, you know, the latest technology is passing me by, leaving me behind the curve of sophistication, as it were? You camp out in line at the store and you walk out with the latest smartphone 007 Doppler XXL Supermax. And within a couple months, the manufacturers announced that they're coming out with a new updated version, one that's even better than the one you're currently holding in your hand. Yours is no longer the new one, and for some pompous folks, yours is obsolete. Couple that with the pronouncements by so many so-called experts that the latest technology has replaced older, different ways of doing things. Film is dead. Books are dead. Board games are passé. Even the most grievous pronouncement that print itself is dead. This month, I'll discuss an author who considers those pronouncements somewhat premature. Not only is the old way of doing things keeping a place at the table, in some cases, it's doing quite well, thank you very much. So put down your smartphones and give a listen. For this month, it's the revenge of analog. Welcome to the Nordonia Hills Branch Library Podcast on Nonfiction. David Sachs is our author this month, and he has written his book called The Revenge of Analog: Real Things and Why They Matter. In his introduction, he presents how he first got turned on to this topic for a book, and what he hopes this book to be, and what he does not consider this book to be. The notion that analog deserved reconsideration first came up on the author's horizon some years ago when he observed new record stores opening, record stores that sold vinyl records. Now, people who are old enough can remember vinyl records before there was any such thing as a compact disc. Of course, nowadays, compact discs themselves are being replaced by streaming audio. When vinyl records left the store, most of us considered that that was probably a dead technology. But when it came to the author's attention that record stores were not just surviving, but actually thriving, in this day and age, he thought that signaled something, and he began to take note. The author describes the actual experience of playing a vinyl record and some of its appeal. The experience of listening to a record was less efficient, more cumbersome, and not necessarily sonically superior to a digital file played on the same stereo. But the act of playing a record seemed more involved and ultimately more rewarding than listening to the same music off of a hard drive. The physical browsing of album spines on the shelf, the careful examination of the art on the sleeve, the diligent needle drop, and that 1 second pause between its contact with the record's vinyl surface and the first scratchy waves of sound emerging from the speakers. It all involved more of our physical senses, requiring the use of our hands, feet, eyes, ears, and even mouth as we blew dust from the record's surface. There was a richness to the vinyl record experience that transcended any quantifiable measurement. It was more fun precisely because it was less efficient. Along with the record stores, he described a dinner party in which he and his wife were the only two out of the eight people in attendance that were not paying attention to their BlackBerries. The other six attendees at the dinner all had their BlackBerries out and on the table or in their hands. Further along in his introduction, he defines what analog means to him. Analog is, in the broadest sense of the term, the opposite of digital. Digital is the language of computers, the binary code of ones and zeros. Analog is the yin to digital yang, its day to its night. It doesn't require a computer to function, and most often analog exists in the physical world as opposed to the virtual one. He goes on that as he began to see the world through this prism, he noticed something else. Certain technologies and processes that had recently been rendered supposedly obsolete suddenly began to show new life, even as the world around them was increasingly driven by digital technology. Every week, I'd walk down the street, and I'd find a new boutique focused on an analog pursuit that had nothing to do with computers. Letterpress cards and invitations, film photography, handmade leather goods and watches, new print magazines, fountain pens, and, of course, vinyl records. A board game cafe opened up around the corner from our apartment, and it had a line out the door from day one. He discusses why he's writing the book, why he's telling the story. The narrative, he says, shows the process of technological innovation isn't a story of slow march from good to better to best. It's a series of trials that helps us understand who we are and how we operate. Analog's revenge is occurring precisely because digital technology has become so damn good. Digital's overwhelming superiority initially renders the analog alternative largely worthless and devalues that analog technology significantly. But over time, the perception of value shifts. The honeymoon with a particular digital technology inevitably ends, and when it does, we are more readily able to judge its true merits and shortcomings. In many cases, an older analog tool or approach simply works better. Its inherent inefficiency grows coveted. Its weakness becomes a renewed strength. He also discusses that he does not consider this book a screed against digital technology. The individuals, companies, organizations, and projects that are presented in his book are not driven by some sort of rose-colored nostalgia for an idealized pre-digital past. There's not a Luddite among them. These people are incredibly forward-thinking, and they are incredibly innovative. They use every digital tool available to them. Crowdfunding online, social media, design software, smartphones, to bring analog goods and services to market. They aren't pushing the digital world away. Rather, they're pulling the analog one closer and using its every advantage to succeed. So with the very clear-thinking introduction, you proceed into the book, in which the author has laid out 9 chapters in 2 different parts, the revenge of analog ideas and the revenge of analog things. The chapters are all standalone snapshots of a certain project, a certain good, a certain individual who's bringing analog to the people of the 21st century. You will read about firms that are introducing new methods of instant photography, similar to the old Polaroids of yesteryear, and they're making lots of money doing it. One company that he focuses on is called The Impossible Project, whose film packs are sold to the tune of over $1 million per year. Another chapter discusses the resurgence in board games over the past decade and a half. How at the very core of it, board games represent a need for human interaction on the parts of the users. And so many people are embracing this and enjoying these games more and more each year. On page 101, he gets down to the chapter near and dear to the librarian's heart, The Revenge of Print. He discusses a number of different areas of print's resurgence, how ebook sales have somewhat plateaued, and how the various areas of print are dealing with the new business landscape, some more successfully than others. Books seem to be the strongest. They seem to retain their appeal to people across the spectrum and worldwide. Magazines are making somewhat of a comeback, but the magazine world is always full of churn, as they would call it, and new magazines are always being introduced while other magazines are closing up shop. And then, of course, there are newspapers, whose business model is evolving to the point where there are now some titles that are basically newspapers printed on demand to a very small subscriber base. One chapter focuses on the revenge of paper, with the unique story of the moleskin notebooks and journals. This chapter is so rich and so well written and so interesting that it is worth picking up the book just for this chapter. Because he touches not only on the story of the company and how it developed and how it grew, it talks about the innovation and the use of it in different areas and different offices and different industries, and how this product, the moleskin notebook, has become ubiquitous in so many creative endeavors, and with so many creative types, it almost becomes a badge of honor or a signal to people that you are creative, because it is used so widely around the world. It is truly a success story, and in just over 20 years. The epilogue chapter presents yet another viewpoint, that of the technology-free summer camp. It describes this summer camp, appropriately named Camp Walden, as a place for children to go where all technological devices are taken from them, collected up, at the beginning of their stay, and returned to them at the end. Their philosophy statement reads along the lines of, "We want campers to experience nature with all their senses, engage directly with each other without the separation of a screen, encourage children to develop their sense of accomplishment and well-being through hands-on activities, and we want them to get their hands dirty." To be honest, he describes how a lot of children don't appreciate that at the outset, but then come to really value their experience once they're done. Of course, they eagerly return to their tech devices as soon as they're given back to them at the end of their stay. Towards the end of the book, the author cites a quote by Kevin Kelly, one of the founding editors of Wired magazine. "Technologies have a social dimension beyond their mere mechanical performance. We adopt new technologies largely because of what they do for us, but also in part because of what they mean to us. Often, we refuse to adopt technology for the same reason, because of how the avoidance reinforces or shapes our identity. Groups or individuals will reject all kinds of technologically advanced innovations simply because they can, or because everyone else accepts them, or because they clash with their self-conception, or because they don't mind doing things with more effort. People will choose to abstain from or forsake particular global standards of technology as a form of idiosyncratic distinction." Mr. Sachs follows up that with another thought, which goes along the lines of, "No one, including the author, advocates a return to the pre-digital lives we once knew. No one is flinging their phones into lakes or exclusively living off the grid. An entirely analog existence was unattainable and unattractive, but so was an exclusively digital one. What was ideal, and what lays behind the revenge of analog, is striking a balance between the two." So if today's digital lifestyle is getting a bit too hectic for you at times, sit down with Mr. Sachs's book, The Revenge of Analog, and take a look at how some people are carving out their own special place between the analog and the digital worlds, inclusive of both, and how these people are finding a market for their ideas and their products, and are being quite successful along the way. Join us again next month when we'll discuss another topic on nonfiction. Until then, we'll see you at your Nordonia Hills Branch Library. Music by 20 Riverside, provided by Mevio's Music Alley. Music.mevio.com. Thank you for listening.